Well, as was said, I hope everyone is having a peaceful Sabbath. You know, every year, God's holy days have a peculiar habit of sneaking up on us. That's not to say that we don't know they're coming, but in many ways, no different than another birthday or anniversary. The more time which passes, it seems, especially the older we get, you blink your eyes and say, "Here we go again." So in the spirit of Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread, which will be here before you know it, I'd like to begin by asking the question, who was the Pharaoh of the Exodus? That's also my SBS and title. Again, who was the Exodus Pharaoh? Now let me pose a second question. How many have been weaned on the idea or belief that the Exodus Pharaoh was Ramses II? That's what I used to believe, and not without reason. Popular films about the Exodus, including the 1956 classic The Ten Commandments, featured Yul Brynner as Ramses II. But not everyone agrees. Sigmund Freud, the popular psychologist, for example, studied the question, believing the Exodus Pharaoh was Akhenaten. Meanwhile, Herman Hay, some of us might remember Dr. Hay, initially believed that it was Nemtiamsof II, but later changed his mind to the person whom I believe was the correct answer. Now, before we proceed any further, we should pause to address what some of you might be thinking, which is, if not Ramses, then how do we explain his name appearing in Scripture? Exodus chapter 1, verse 11, for example, says that the Israelites built the cities of Pithom and Ramses, the latter usually associated with Ramses II and his construction of Pi-Ramses. Well, the most notable problem here would be that Ramses hadn't been born yet. He wouldn't arrive on the scene for another 200 years, not until the 13th century BC. So how could Israelites build something for a person who hadn't been born yet? And that's not the only problem. Let us further consider that identifying the Exodus Pharaoh as Ramses, based on this verse, leads to other issues. For instance, Exodus chapter 2, verse 23 states that this earlier Pharaoh died before Moses returned to save the Israelites. So even if Exodus 1:11 was a link to Ramses, then Exodus 2:23 would disqualify him from being the Pharaoh with whom Moses later contended. So what's going on here? How do we explain this? Well, simply stated, these references are scribal edits known as anachronisms. Now, the definition is on the screen before you, and it reads, a thing belonging or appropriate to a period other than that in which it exists. Or said another way, an anachronism is a more familiar later term used for a more obscure earlier name. Similarly, we might use the name France when describing ancient Gaul, or the name Iran instead of Persia, or Thailand instead of Siam, etc. Therefore, such a scribal edit, as featured here, could have been accomplished by Ezra, or even the prophet Samuel, who was a contemporary of Ramses. Moreover, Samuel is traditionally ascribed to the early compilation of the Hebrew texts, particularly Joshua, Judges, and 1 Samuel, which put an emphasis on place names, quote, as they are to this day. Now, surely that's a phrase we've read hundreds, if not thousands of times without even realizing it. In any event, we needn't speculate that Ramses was being used as a place name because it already had been in Genesis chapter 47, verse 11. Let's go there next. Several hundred years before Exodus 1:11 even occurred, we see the word Ramses, but likewise, not as someone participating in the narrative. Notice, and Joseph situated his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded. Our conclusion, then, is that the Ramesses of Exodus, as also seen here, was a later name used to describe an earlier, lesser-known location, which coincidentally matches the testimony of our earliest Egyptian record, that of the 3rd century BC Manetho. He repeatedly associated the Israelites with the earlier city of Arras, as relayed throughout much of Josephus's Against Apion, Book 1. Later, however, Ramses the Man would construct his capital, Pi-Ramses, on the northern end of Avaris, near the site of the former original city. This lush green area, also called the Nile Delta, is where Goshen was located, hence the reference found in Exodus 12:37, and its counterpart, Numbers 33:3, which identify Ramses as Israel's origin of departure, meaning it was geographic. Therefore, again, such passages are not a timestamp of authorship. Rather, they are anachronisms. They are scribal edits made by one of God's prophets describing a location as it's called to this day. Now, that being the case, we should briefly consider why the Bible simply doesn't tell us Pharaoh's name. There is, in fact, a rational explanation. A reoccurring motif in the Bible is the notion of blotting out the name of the enemy, i.e., 2 Kings 14, Deuteronomy 29, Psalm 83. In Exodus 32, Moses himself even discusses the possibility of his own name being blotted or erased. In the case of the Exodus Pharaoh, however, there are certain passages which suggest the intentional erasure of his name from the biblical text. Isaiah chapter 26, verses 13 through 14 says, "O Lord, our God, other lords besides thee have had dominion over us," i.e. a direct inference to Pharaoh. "But by thee only do we make mention of thy name. Thou punished and destroyed them and made all their memory to perish." So, verses like this enable us to understand why there's confusion about who Pharaoh was. However, they do not say that it's unsearchable or that we cannot know. Moreover, there's another reason for the ambiguity surrounding this Pharaoh, and that reason is called damnatio memoriae. In archaeology, this is the act of excising or removing embarrassing acts, incidents, and people from historical records of which the Egyptians did well. In other words, you could describe them as the original fake news media. In fact, every historian agrees the ancients commonly airbrushed humiliating details from their own history, especially defeats in battle. But as was said, that doesn't mean that we cannot know. That doesn't mean that it's unsearchable. Scripture says that God conceals a matter, but the glory of kings is to do what? To search it out, right? Therefore, next, let's identify the period. Egypt is one of the oldest and best documented civilizations in human history. From troves of archaeological evidence and numerous historical data, we can divide its history into periods. The majority of scholars and experts generally agree that the Exodus fits within Egypt's New Kingdom period, which spanned the second half of the second millennium BC. Chronologically, then, this time frame encompasses the entire period of the Exodus, Israel's sojourn into the wilderness, and the time of the judges. This New Kingdom period not only fits tidily with events relating to the biblical Exodus, it also fits with the literary composition of the Torah itself. The Mosaic books are filled with language, references, and nuances, from the use of pharaonic phrases to personal names that are uniquely associated with Egypt's New Kingdom period. Now, with that said, let's get more specific by narrowing this even further. Historians divide the New Kingdom into three separate dynasties. The first is the 18th, which is called the Thutmosid, named after the ruling family. And this dynasty ruled Egypt from about 1570 to 1300 BC, coinciding precisely with the Exodus. We know this because of 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, which is key. This verse connects the Exodus to the construction of Solomon's temple. And here's what it says. And it came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, he began to build the house of the Lord. Therefore, thanks to this verse, calculating the date of the Exodus is simple. 480 years prior to Solomon's fourth year, aka 967 to 966 BC, places the Exodus, and therefore the Red Sea crossing, in 1446 BC, which further places Israel's conquest of the Promised Land in 1406, i.e. accounting for the time they spent wandering in the wilderness. Now, before introducing other corroborating evidence, which we'll do, I need to share something that might seem unrelated, but indeed, I can assure you, is related. Right now, at this exact place in the sermon, that is to say, when I was preparing it, this is the place I nearly scrapped the entire message and walked away. And that's because I had discovered that 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, the passage we just read, is considered a textual variant. So when it comes to intellectual honesty, that was a problem. To illustrate my meaning, I'll again read part of the verse, but this time, as it appears in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament scriptures, quote, "And it came to pass in the 440th year after the departure of the children of Israel out of Egypt." Did you catch the difference? This specifies 440 years, while the text preserved by the Masoretes said 480. Now, granted, such has no bearing on the Exodus having occurred during the Thutmose dynasty, but still, the variance of 40 years could mean the difference between one pharaoh versus another. So, is there a definitive answer as to which variant we can trust? Indeed, there is. Before getting there, however, let me first share the implication of each scenario. On one hand, if the Septuagint is correct, then after wandering in the wilderness, Israel's conquest of the Promised Land began in 1366 BC. Whereas on the other hand, if the Masoretic text is correct, for which your King James is based, then Israel would have entered Canaan 40 years earlier. Now, what I'm going to share with you next was very exciting to me. Not only was I inspired to resume work on this message, but I did so with vigor. According to Leviticus 25, the Jubilee cycles were to begin when Israel entered the Promised Land. Remember that. In fact, let me repeat that. According to Leviticus 25, the Jubilee cycles were to begin when Israel entered the Promised Land. Therefore, springboarding from several known cycles identified in the Talmud, we can calculate backwards to see which date is correct. And as it turns out, one can likewise accomplish the same task from Scripture. Take Ezekiel chapter 40, verse 1, for example. We know that the 25th year of exile coincided with the beginning of a jubilee. We know this because when heralding the new year, the priests blew the shofar on the 10th day of the 7th month and not on the 1st, as was the normal practice. Did you know that? I didn't. Not until researching this message, anyway, that for 49 consecutive years, the civil new year began on trumpets. Then, in the 50th year, following God's command, the priests deviated by blowing the shofar on atonement. So again, calculating backwards from the 25th year of exile, aka a jubilee, brings us to the exact same date as though we had run our calculation from those cycles mentioned in the Talmud. Therefore, brethren, as corroborated through numerous methods, all independent of the other, in which math doesn't lie, the very first Jubilee cycle began in, drumroll please, 1406 BC, which means the Masoretes had it right all along. 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1 then, as conveyed in your King James Bible, is correct, whereas the aberration appearing in the Septuagint is clearly wrong. Therefore, with the dates of the Canaanite conquest, and thus the biblical Exodus firmly established, we can now reconstruct a timeline of Moses' life. In other words, since we know how old Moses was relative to various significant events, then we can safely calculate everything from his birth to his death. Now, one might assume that overlaying this atop the timeline of the Thutmosid dynasty should reveal the pharaoh in question, right? Oh, if it only were that simple. No, as it turns out, it's remarkably more difficult. Yes, we have our period and we know who the players were. And yes, we even know the order in which they served. But we also have something called high chronology versus low chronology. We have the opinion of this Egyptologist versus the opinion of that historian, and so on and so forth. Therefore, absent something definitive upon which to anchor, we're left with a sliding scale. In other words, because we're dealing with pharaohs who lived 3,500 years ago, things can get a little dicey when trying to determine the exact year of birth, co-regency, sole regency, and death. Plus, when you tweak the date range of one, well, then guess what? Such invariably affects everyone else in the chain. Therefore, it's more prudent we determine the best candidate by looking for evidence of certain phenomena described in the Bible and comparing that to what's known about each pharaoh. Make sense? Again, we have our period, New Kingdom. We even have our dynasty, Thutmosid. Now we can look more closely at the specific pharaohs. Therefore, we'll begin our examination with Sigmund Freud's pick. As you may recall, he favored Pharaoh Akhenaten, a early 14th century BC figure. Akhenaten's reign marked a time of major upheaval in Canaan, which at the time was nominally controlled by Egypt as a vassal territory. The disturbance was primarily due to the violent conquests within Canaan of the Habiru people, as documented in what's famously called the Armana Letters. More specifically, the Armana Letters consist of 382 clay tablets that were discovered in Egypt dating to the 14th century BC. Many of these tablets are inscribed with text written by numerous regional Canaanite rulers or mayors requesting foreign aid, and even terror at the fact that their land was being overrun again by people whom they called the Habiru. The small blockish clay tablets are named after the location of their discovery in El Armana, a major Egyptian city of the 14th century BC, which again puts us in the time frame we want. For documentation purposes, they've all been numbered EA1 through EA382. I'll now share several examples, the first of which possibly intended for Amenhotep III, but again, the majority written during the tenure of his son, Pharaoh Akhenaten, who was the primary ruler in Egypt when these desperate pleas were made. EA 299 was a request by Yapahu, the ruler of Gezer, a Canaanite city situated west of Jerusalem in the foothills of the Judean mountains. Quote, "To the king, my lord, since the Habiru are stronger than we, may the king, my lord, give me his help, And may the king, my lord, get me away from the Habi Roo, lest the Habi Roo destroy us. By the way, these are actual pics of the very tablets being quoted. This next one is EA 286, which comes from Abdi Heba, the mayor of Jerusalem. Message of Abdi Heba, your servant. May the king provide for his land. All the lands of the king, my lord, have deserted. Lost are all the mayors. There is not a mayor remaining to the king, my lord. The king has no lands. The Habi Roo have plundered all the lands of the king. If there are archers this year, the lands of the king, my lord, will remain. In EA 288, Jerusalem's mayor once again beseeches Pharaoh Akhenaten. Notice the description of the far-reaching extent of the Habi Roo into Canaan. May the king give thought to his land. The land of the king is lost. All of it has attacked me. I am situated like a ship in the midst of the sea. Now the Habi Roo have taken the very cities of the king. Not a single mayor remains to the king, my lord. All are lost. Have you figured out the identity of the Habi Roo yet? A handful of atheistic historians, despising the historicity of the Bible, have speculated that the Habi Roo were nothing more than a band of rogue marauders running up and down Canaan, creating havoc. Of course, there's several notable problems with this hypothesis, not the least of which being that Habi Roo is Akkadian for Hebrew, but it also takes more than a few troublemakers to conquer an entire country. Therefore, with this in mind, and in no particular order, let's compare several more of these letters to the Bible so as to form our own educated opinion. First, regarding the city of Akko. According to Armana, Akko initially helps the Canaanite war effort against the Habi Roo, but then changes sides and is allowed favor. According to the Bible, the Israelites stop shy of expelling the inhabitants of Akko and allow them to remain, but only under tribute. So, clearly there's a match here. Regarding Akshaf, according to Armana, the king of Akshaf comes to fight in coalition against the Habi Roo. According to the Bible, the king of Akshaf comes to fight in coalition against the Hebrews and is killed. Another match. Regarding Ahazalon, according to Armana, the enemy Habi Roo have taken control of Ahazalon and the countryside. According to the Bible, after a major land battle, Israel conquers Ahazalon with the open land about it. Regarding Beth Shean, according to Armana, a strong garrison is prepared and stationed at Beth Shean to defend itself from the Habi Roo. According to the Bible, the Israelites fret about iron chariots stationed at Beth Shean. Gebel, according to Armana, the king of Gebel worries that the Habi Roo about the Habi Roo potentially attacking his city. However, there is no indication that it was. According to the Bible, Joshua informs the Israelites that the northern lands, including Gebel, still need to be conquered. However, there is no biblical statement that they were. Regarding Hebron, according to Armana, Hebron teams up with Jerusalem and Lachish to war against the invading Habi Roo. Supportively, again, according to the Bible, the king of Hebron teams up with the kings of Jerusalem, Lachish, and others at Gibeon where they battle, but then get completely routed by Joshua anyway. Subsequently, Hebron is later attacked and conquered. Regarding Shechem, according to Armana, the Habi Roo are literally handed the land of Shechem by its ruler, Labayu. According to the Bible, no description of an attack is recorded, but the Israelites are shown as having acquired it. Now, we could keep going here, but I think you get the idea. I actually did have more comparisons prepared, but for sake of time, we'll simply default to Akhenaten's reaction, and to a lesser extent, the reaction of his father, Amenhotep III, who was pharaoh when the Hebrew conquest began. In a word, their reaction was passive. In fact, they couldn't have been more passive had they simply said, "Good luck." I know Joshua is over there literally kicking you up the hindquarters, but again, good luck. And what's more telling was the simultaneous collapse of Egypt's religious system. His father laid the groundwork, but Akhenaten took the country from polytheism to monotheism. Notice what he said, quote, "The temples of the gods are fallen to ruin. Their bodies do not endure. I have watched as they have ceased their appearances one after the other. All of them have stopped, except the God who gave birth to himself. And no one knows the mystery of how he performs his tasks. This God goes where he pleases, and no one else knows his going." Now, despite this insightful comment, Akhenaten still didn't know the one true God. Rather, he just assumed that God was the sun god, or perhaps the sun itself. But was it mere coincidence that within the same dynasty, and chronologically only decades after the biblical Exodus, during which Egypt's various gods were proven powerless, that we should witness such a moving and unthinkable speech? Could this Pharaoh's religious reforms have been the consequence of what the Bible identifies as plagues aimed against all the gods of Egypt? Next, let's rewind the timeline even further, going back one generation by briefly examining Akhenaten's father. I mentioned him already, Amenhotep III. I mentioned him as being Pharaoh when the Canaanite conquest began. But is there anything else from his reign that we should know? Well, despite his long tenure, he is known to have participated in only one small military campaign south of Egypt. But perhaps more intriguing was his construction of statues. Lots and lots of statues. Amenhotep III commissioned over 600 figures that were devoted to Sekhmet, the goddess of healing. So why the emphasis on healing? And finally, a pylon inscription from his royal necropolis at Soleb refers to a nomadic group of people called the Shazu, or nomads of Yahweh. No further detail is recorded about this wandering body of people, other than the fact that they were apparently located somewhere east of Egypt. Amenhotep's inscription is, by the way, the earliest known mention of the famous name of Israel's God. This name, also called the Tetragrammaton, appears over 6,800 times in the Hebrew Scriptures and wasn't known before Moses' time, not even by the patriarchs. Again, was it coincidence that Amenhotep III's reign fits with Israel's nomadic sojourn, or that the end of his reign and the beginning of Akhenaten's fits with Israel's conquest of Canaan? And isn't it interesting that Egypt, under Amenhotep III, experienced an uncharacteristic pacifism with a peculiar devotion to Sekhmet, the goddess of healing, followed by the eventual transformation of Egypt's religious system? You discern. All right, are we ready to rewind another generation? Amenhotep III's father and predecessor was Pharaoh Thutmose IV. This pharaoh reigned for only 9 years. Short though it was, Thutmose's rule was a surprise. We know this thanks to the Dream Stele. The Dream Stele is a 4-meter-tall granite inscription installed between the paws of the Great Sphinx in Giza. This massive stone was erected during the first year of Thutmose IV's reign. The text, commissioned by Thutmose IV himself, essentially constitutes divine justification for his reign, aka propaganda. Now, why do you suppose this ruler felt compelled to publicly declare in stone that he was hand-selected by the gods and, as such, the right man for the job? It's because he wasn't the firstborn, that's why. Quote, "It is unfortunate that the events surrounding the ascension of Thutmose IV are so obscure," wrote Egyptologist Peter der Manuelian, "especially since his dream stele between the paws of the great Sphinx suggests that he was not the originally intended heir to the throne." Well, so what happened to the firstborn whose place Thutmose assumed? The fact that Thutmose IV was not the firstborn son and assumed Egypt's throne unexpectedly fits squarely with the biblical account of the 10th plague, the death of the firstborn, which included Egypt's crown prince. Quote, "And it came to pass at midnight that the Lord smote all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sat on his throne, unto the firstborn of the captive that was in the dungeon." But there's more. Not to sound like a QVC commercial, but wait, there really is more. The fact that the Pharaoh of the Exodus survived the 10th plague logically implies that he too was not a firstborn. And fascinatingly, Egyptian records reveal that the father of Thutmose IV, Egypt's ruler in the crucial middle part of the 15th century BC, was likewise not the firstborn heir to the throne. In logical progression, then, especially since we're now encroaching into the time frame of 1446 BC, this would place Thutmose IV's father as the most likely pharaoh of the Exodus. I say most likely as a disclaimer. Frankly, this is one of those topics where it's good to allow a little wiggle room. So when you hear me say likely or most likely, that's why. All right, thus far we've examined some of the Thutmose pharaohs who came after the Exodus, going backwards in time. But before we expose the likely identity of the Exodus pharaoh himself, let's go back even further. Let us consider the pharaoh who immediately preceded him, that is, the ruler from whom Moses fled when he escaped to Midian. Indeed, it was in association with this pharaoh, Thutmose III, that the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up unto God. Thutmose III set about forging himself into arguably Egypt's greatest, most powerful pharaoh. Through his many campaigns, he created the largest empire Egypt had ever seen. And he had plenty of time to do it. His lengthy rule spanned most of the first half of the 15th century BC. Supportively, the first part of the same verse shares, "And it came to pass in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died." Now, the phrase "many days" is not only a reference to Moses' lengthy stay in Midian, but it's also an obvious reference to the lengthy reign of Egypt's pharaoh at that time. In fact, we could even make the argument that this pharaoh, Thutmose III, including others in his administration, in order to properly match the biblical criteria, needed to have had a reign which exceeded 40 years. Notice Exodus chapter 4, verse 19 confirms. "Now the Lord said to Moses, go, return to Egypt, for all the men who sought your life are dead." So the Pharaoh who sought to kill Moses back in Exodus 2:15, including the last of his cohorts, had apparently now all died some 40 years later. Brethren, including his co-regency, Thutmose III reigned a total of 54 years, one of the longest in Egyptian history. But more importantly, he's the only one to have reigned more than 40 in the entire dynasty. So, disclaimers aside, Thutmose III is the only candidate that fits here. Again, another box checked, and more criteria met. In any event, if Thutmose III preceded the Exodus Pharaoh, then his firstborn son and heir apparent, the royal prince Amenemhat, would presumably be the Exodus Pharaoh, right? Well, no. According to Egyptian records, Amenemhat preceded his father in death. Therefore, when Pharaoh Thutmose III finally died, Egypt's throne was inherited by his second son. As you may recall, we previously established this. We're effectively looking for two pharaohs in a row. The one who ruled after the Exodus, due to the 10th and final plague, was not a firstborn. And likewise, neither was the Exodus pharaoh himself, being that he lived through Passover. His name? The one whom history identifies as being the most likely candidate was Amenhotep II, also known as the most sadistic among his name's sake. As featured in Dr. Manuelian's authoritative work on Amenhotep II, Manuelian, whom I mentioned earlier, wrote that the pharaohs Amada and Elephantine Stele, again, a.k.a. stone inscriptions, seem to emphasize first and foremost the glorification of the king through examples of excessive cruelty, whereby he may have taken royal ruthfulness to new extremes. His textual inscriptions reveal a penchant for what seems almost a casual narrations of the king's gruesome treatment of his enemies. On his year 3 campaign, for example, the record indicates how he transported enemy leaders tied upside down to the bow of his royal ship before nailing them, minus their hands, to the walls of Thebes and Napata. In fact, in his sermon titled Egyptian Belief versus Biblical Truth, Mr. Sexton spoke a little bit on this. Evidently, it was common for the conquering Egyptians to remove the hands of their enemy. Such had to do with their belief of the afterlife. Now, continuing, both the Karnak and Memphis narratives give a description of the king's might and brutality, explains Manuelian, in which on his year 9 campaign, Amenhotep II ordered trenches to be dug, which he then filled with prisoners whom he set ablaze in a fiery holocaust. These textual accounts correspond to the various artistic depictions of the pharaoh, scenes that depict the king in his chariot with bound captives tied to his chassis. You know, if Egypt is a representation for the world and of sin and spiritual confusion and death from which we've been called, then it stands to follow that Pharaoh Amenhotep II must then represent who? He represents Satan. In other words, our ancestors, the Israelites, weren't begging God for lack of pay as they lobbied for safer working conditions. Rather, this pharaoh, a type of Satan, was literally fixated on enslaving people. As an illustration, in the same previously mentioned campaign, Amenhotep II reportedly imported more than 101,000 captives from the Levant, the highest number of slaves brought into Egypt by any pharaoh ever. Hence the mixed multitude described in Exodus 12:38 that took their exit alongside Israel. But perhaps the most notable observation about the archaeological record of Amenhotep II pertains mostly to the latter half of his reign. In short, it's virtually non-existent. Of the remainder of his reign, after year 9, that is, we know nothing wrote Sir William Petrie. He continued, "Nothing strikes us as more extraordinary than the condition of injury and confusion in which the most important buildings of Egypt seem to have remained. The most imposing works stood amidst half-ruined and unfinished halls. Other structures were either incomplete or half-ruined." Archaeologist Dr. Scott Stripling added this striking detail. "Much of the Avaris stratum, a.k.a. the Nile Delta, points to the presence of a Semitic population until a mysterious abandonment in the mid-18th dynasty." So what happened? Well, I think we know what happened because we read about it every Passover season, if not more. But isn't it special when the Bible becomes tangible in ways not previously expected? In fact, my only regret for this message is that we don't have more time to explore other historical aspects from the period, exposing the possible identities of Pharaoh's daughter, the one who named Moses after the familial dynastic moniker Tutmosid, or even the administrative official whom Moses killed in 1486 BC, whose body was never found, or how this was just fodder for the then teenage Thutmose III, who was already gunning for Moses, hence the proactive assertion made by Moses himself that should his act of killing the Egyptian become known, that he'd be a dead man. And quickly, one final observation of Thutmose III, that is to say, being that he only had one half-sister, should anything had happened to him before he was able to produce an heir, not that anything would have happened, but just in case something did, then guess who the only qualified person left to run Egypt during that brief window would have been? Yeah, it gives new meaning to Hebrews 11:24, doesn't it? That by faith, Moses refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Wonder why she was so intent that people identify Moses as her son, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than what? Well, than the treasures in Egypt. It was at his fingertips. And boy, oh boy, how that might have changed Egyptian history. Can you imagine a Pharaoh Moses? If you can, then you probably wouldn't be the first. I think Pharaoh's daughter, the one who raised Moses, must have imagined it many times over. This same woman whom Scripture says Moses refused to be called the son of. You know, there's only one reason to fool people into thinking she had a son, and that was to make him an heir. All right, getting back on track. In fairness to this topic, I need to share an opposing view. The biggest argument leveled against Amenhotep II being the Exodus Pharaoh is that we have his body. The irony about this argument, however, is that it's not a valid argument, namely because we have all their bodies. Every pharaoh from the period is lying in a museum somewhere. So if not Amenhotep, then who? And besides that, the assertion relies too heavily on the means by which he died, presuming that his body was unrecoverable, which is simply untrue. Exodus chapter 14, verse 30, for example, states that the Egyptian bodies washed ashore. Now, the same proponents also point to Amenhotep II having a reign that lasted considerably longer than his ninth year. So if he died in the Red Sea, they argue, then how do we account for him being alive afterwards? But again, were they there? Recall, this was the dark period for which Sir William Petrie said, "We know nothing." Therefore, we don't know whether or not someone else, a viceroy perhaps, continued in Pharaoh's stead until Thutmose IV was old enough to assume control. Plus, remember, damnatio memoriae, excising embarrassing acts, and the purposeful airbrushing of history. In other words, no way, no way Egypt would have recorded one of their own going down, let alone their fearsome leader. But it does beg the question, how did Pharaoh die? This is something we should briefly consider, because although it's been debated ad nauseum, the Bible is clear. Quote, "So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came in to the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained." Now, granted, this passage focuses more on Pharaoh's army than it does on him. But of the same passage, notice how Psalm 106 verses 10 through 11 phrases it. He, meaning God, saved them from the hand of him who hated them. Remember what I said about Satan? That's probably more so a reference to him, but then the verse continues. And redeemed them from the hand of the enemy. The waters covered their enemies. There was not one of them left. So was Pharaoh an enemy? Here, both he and his army are lumped together, in which none remain. Psalm 136, verses 13 through 15, goes even further. And in my opinion, this is inescapable. Notice it. "To him who divided the Red Sea in two and made Israel pass through the midst of it, but overthrew Pharaoh and his army in the Red Sea." Now, would you believe that volumes have been written on how these verses don't mean what they say? I know, because in preparation for this message, I sifted through that minutia. Professor Douglas Petrovich, for example, in his Digging for Truth podcast, explained how the Hebrew word for overthrew doesn't necessarily mean to kill, and therefore Pharaoh may not have really died. Now, irrespective of the various nuances associated with this word, let me ask you, where does this passage very clearly put Pharaoh? In the Red Sea. And all who went in died. Not so much as one survived, the Bible says. Now let me ask you another question. What is the Red Sea comprised of? Salt water or fresh water? As it turns out, the northern part where Israel crossed is 4% higher in concentration than the average salinity of the ocean. I share that because water density equals increased buoyancy, ergo the bodies that washed ashore. Or as a modern equivalent, you might Google pictures of tourists floating in the Dead Sea, making it near impossible to dive. But there's an additional reason I draw your attention toward the unusually high concentration of salt. In 1907, when Amenhotep II's mummified body was examined, scientists discovered, or noticed rather, the presence of something quite unusual. Now, fair warning, I am going to show his body. This isn't for shock value, but rather it makes sense that if we're going to talk about an autopsy, then it might benefit you to see a visual. So we'll briefly view the picture, then we'll talk about it afterwards, okay? Here we go. Probably not what you expected, huh? Could this be the guy who went head-to-head with Moses and lost? Really, he went head-to-head against God, didn't he? Grafton Elliott Smith, who studied the corpse, had this to say, quote, "The skin over the whole body is thickly studded with small projections or tubercles, At present, I am unable to determine whether they are the results of some disease, aka a plague, there were 10, or merely the effects of the embalmer's salt bath. But they certainly are unusual. Yeah, I'd say he took a salt bath, all right. One of the highest percentages of salinity in the world, as it turns out. The American Journal of Physical Anthropology added the following. We have two interesting scenarios. The first suggests that this is Amenhotep II, with a body bearing the scars of plague or disease. The second suggests that this is someone else entirely from the time period, with the pharaoh's body remaining at large. Based on the collective evidence, the former seems the most probable, that this is Amenhotep II. His body could have been recovered from Egypt's defeat at the Red Sea and subsequently embalmed in accordance with Egyptian tradition. Brethren, at the beginning I asked the question, who was the Pharaoh of the Exodus? Well, after digging into the details, it becomes evident that no other Egyptian period, dynasty, and pharaoh gets nearly as close to matching the biblical criteria than the New Kingdom's Tutmosid pharaoh, Amenhotep II. Happy Sabbath.